Yeah, he's coming on now.
Shango, moju baile, Shango, oni wano, eri jaja, ori shako, eru male, Shango.
To take Africans out of this continent were the Arabs. And they took Africans from the eastern coast. And it's sad that in that part of the world, there are not many Africans who remain, because it was in the business of the Arab enslaver to castrate Africans. We never say that, but we must say, because it is historically significant. Then the Europeans came. Africa became the hunting ground for the European colonizers. Our ancestors built the United States of America. Our ancestors built Europe. And when slavery had lost its shine and sheen, the Europeans abolished it. But they replaced it with yet another pernicious enterprise, the colonization of Africa. This time round, they did not take us away. They came here and they controlled us. And they told us, not in so many words, that we were children of a lesser God. But yet there is a sense in which the God that we worship never sleeps. The colonial enterprise ran its course. And the European tribes, the Europeans never called themselves tribes, they called them nations, were engaged in a war. First in 1918, the European tribes fought. And they had something called the League of Nations, which died. Then they fought again in 1945. And what is unique about the European nations is that when they are engaged in tribal wars, they call them world wars. This history is necessary that we are able to appreciate the freedom that we gained. Africans were never quiet. Those who had been taken out had already started agitating. Many of us here will remember Marcus Garvey, of whom Bob Marley says, Garvey was a Buffalo soldier in the heart of America.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good evening and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and we are here on a very lovely Tuesday evening. The temperature here in Lithonia, Georgia, is around 80 degrees, and we have enjoyed a sunny and very beautiful day, and I hope it has been a wonderful day where you are as well. We are here today with another very exciting program. I'm extremely happy to be a part of this wonderful system here at timeforawakening.com. We are working on the network of the Black Talk Radio Network. .com. And so I am just so pleased to be here and to be broadcasting. This is our third broadcast, and we have been extremely excited here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We are part of Motherland Media, is the sponsor for the Black Reality Think Tank. Motherland Media is a wonderful sponsor. Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, who has a program on this network as well called African Perspectives. And also Brother Elliot from Philadelphia, who does the program Time for Awakening. So it is definitely an honor to be a part of such an august body of individuals, very conscious-minded African people who want to do the same thing, and that is resurrect and rescue the African mind. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. That is our subject matter. We want to look at that. We want to look at it in a serious way. As I said, this is the Black Reality Think Tank, and so we want to kind of examine it very critically. Critical thinking is definitely necessary for us as we, consider some of the things that we need to do for our people. And so I do want to look analytically at the whole idea of recapturing the African mind. How do you do that? What is the process for doing that? We have been on this sojourn here in North America over 500 years, either the Caribbean, South America, and here very clearly the United, what's known as the United States in North America, in these colonies. And there has been some serious travesties that have been done. And so we want to look at that tonight. And by all means, we want to engage you, our audience. We're not coming as experts. A lot of times when you're talking about psychology and the mind, obviously, you are talking a very professional area, and I am not coming as a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'm coming as a historian and a brother from the community who's considered very heavily my own state of being, and then obviously those of my people. And so I think my job is to try to help us work that out. I don't have the answers, so I'm not coming with the answers. I'm coming with the talk, the dialogue. I have the history. I know what's behind a lot of this, and we can talk about that, and then obviously talk about what so many people have written about. A lot of our ancestors have approached this subject in their works and books, and we're going to talk about a few of them when we begin. So I'm excited. We have this is a call-in format, and we always welcome your calls to here for you to be able to talk with us and, obviously provide your your programming. And so we are looking forward to you coming with some of your ideas and suggestions. And again, nothing is wrong. Just come with us, whatever you have, present it, and let's go forward from there. But anyway, I do thank you so much for joining us here this afternoon. So we do have this conversation that we want to engage in just a few minutes. One of the other things that we'd like to do is we recognize our ancestors. That's extremely critical here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We want to make sure that we praise them and give their name, place their name into the universe, and just kind of discuss some of the things that they've done for us, because we stand on their shoulders. It would not be possible to do and be here and do the work that we do without the great work of our ancestors. So we want to be able to do that today as well. So we have a feature that we call our Ancestral Profile that I'm going to definitely present in just a few minutes. And then we always like to use the spoken word. You just heard Dr. P.L.O. Lumumba provide a very dynamic message. We also like to use music and give the music for things that are relevant to the subject matter we do. So we have several formats. Anyway, our call-in number is area code 215-490-9832. Area code 215-590-9832. And so, again, we welcome your call. Today, I want to provide an ancestral profile for a very dynamic brother who has just recently joined the ancestrals, the ancestral realm of things. He is transitioned back in 2015, but he was a dynamic and prolific brother. His name is John Williams. He was an author, and we want to talk just a little bit about him. One of the writers for the New York Times indicated that John Williams is really one of the individuals that most people have never heard of. And he has definitely been exciting. And we are really looking forward to having him and talking with him and being able to, understand a little bit about what, his work and what he's done. I just want to make sure that everything is working here. My engineer just texted me that there's a possibility there is a problem. I hope not. He did indicate that he is not hearing me. I'm not sure that that's possible. Let me go to someone that here. So just pardon me just for a minute. I want to make sure. Mr. Pugh, are you on the line? Do you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine, Doctor.
Okay, well, someone just called and said they couldn't hear me. So, okay, thank you. I'm great. And I do apologize that. So to our engineer, something must be on your end because people are hearing me. So I do apologize to our audience for having to interrupt that. But that was good. I'm glad he did let me know. But anyway, we want to talk about John Williams for just a minute. He was a renowned poet and novelist. And although he has often been compared to such people as Richard Wright and James Baldwin, John Williams didn't much like that. He didn't like the idea of being compared to them. He said he's his own person. But but nevertheless, in terms of the style of writing and the way he approached it, that was good. He felt that when black writers were lumped together by the literary establishment, only one at a time would be allowed to succeed. So he didn't like being lumped together with others. His novels, which were always focused through the prism of race and were told from his black character's point of view, which was a good thing. They were well-reviewed. He always got excellent reviews from those that reviewed his work. Williams really never reached the level of, say, maybe a Richard Wright or a Toni Morrison or Alice Walker, but his writings were extremely dynamic. Williams died on July the 3rd, 2015, from complications of Alzheimer's disease in a veteran's home in Paramus, New Jersey. He was 89 years old and is survived by his second wife, Lorraine, and he had three sons, Dennis, Gregory, and Adam, and his sister and several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. As I said, Williams was a prolific writer, penning almost two dozen books and countless essays in his long career. His characters were black, but they were not monolithic. Williams peopled his pages with jazz musicians. In Night Song, they played in a book that he wrote called Night Song. They played in Greenwich Village. He wrote another book called Clifford's Blues. It was a German concentration camp that took place in a German concentration camp. But there were also housekeepers in a book called Sissy. And these were old players trying to keep their game tight in a book called Mother's Eel and the Foxes. And he wrote another book called The Junior Bachelor Society. And Williams also wrote a picture book of Africa and a book for young readers. And with his own son, Dennis, he authored a biography of comedian Richard Pryor. John Williams' best-known book is a long rumination on race, black writers, and political intrigue, which is my favorite by him. It's called The Man Who Cried I Am. The Man Who Cried I Am. The title is a reference to the protagonist's expatriate black writer, Max Reddick, who has achieved success in the white literary world as a black writer. He says that all you ever want to do is remind me I am black. But God damn it, I also am. The book centers on Redrick's discovery through a box of inherited papers of something called the King Alfred Plan. The King Alfred Plan was a government plan to intern and destroy America's black population. King Alfred is a tightly held secret, and the quandary of what next moves the book along. Williams' description of the plan is so persuasive that a lot of folk in New York and places around America thought it was real. And a lot of people were printing up the King Alfred plan and passing it around and saying that this was the kind of stuff that was being done, which is probably true. It was. But it just wasn't called a King Alfred plan. That was John Williams' creation. At one point, it was a must-read by black students in the 1960s. It was a part of the black classics in many cases. One of the UCLA law professors, Dr. Richard Yarborough, said, I didn't read a lot of black literature in college. He said, but The Man Who Cried I Am was one of those required books when you were black and in college and conscious about your blackness. It was a rites of passage kind of book for many black collegians. I've heard Stokely Carmichael even talk about the book and some of the other very strong activists during the civil rights movement. It is a big book, very demanding, says Yarborough. It is full of sophisticated ideas, subtly expressed, and it was a not to stick to the man formula, as some black novels of that period could do, where they want to attempt to attack the white world. He wasn't trying to do that. He was bringing that into operation. Williams was born in Jackson, Mississippi, but his family went north as part of the Great Migration. He attended high school in upstate New York in Syracuse, but left before graduation to join the Navy during World War II. There, Williams served in the Pacific Theater as a medical corpsman. And after his service, Williams went on to Syracuse University on the GI Bill. He moved to New York City and held several public relations jobs before transitioning into a job in journalism. He spent a year as the European correspondent for Ebony and Jet magazine and briefly covered Africa for Newsweek in the mid-1990s. He perceived that he'd only be allowed to go but so far in journalism and left the field. Journalism never left him, though. For one thing, he meant his writings were very clean, says Yarborough. For another, his overseas reporting left him with a world view that was very powerful about the black diaspora, especially the post-colonial Africa and how it connects to the civil rights movement in the United States. It was a point of view ahead of its time. 30 years later, Williams would break more ground with another book called Clifford's Blues. It was a tale about a gay piano player in Nazi Germany who finds himself in a concentration camp. Yarborough says we invited Williams to appear on a panel that discussed black masculinity. John Williams read from his new book. The audience was blown out of the water, Yarborough chuckled, who at the time was addressing black gay issues. John Williams liked stirring the pot, sometimes to the point that it boiled over. Barely 2 years after Martin Luther King was assassinated, Williams wrote, "The King That God Didn't Save, Reflections on the Life and Death of Dr. Martin Luther King." And that's an excellent piece. I had an opportunity to read that. It's called, again, "The King That God Didn't Save, Reflections on the Life and Death of Dr. Martin Luther King." And in it, Williams posited that King's ego had blinded him to the fact that he would always be constrained by the powers that be, only to the victories they would allow him. King's belief in the ultimate beloved community of racial conciliation and harmony, Williams said, it made him unable to perceive the manipulation of white power, and at the end of white power killed him. For black believers and white liberals, for people who hung commemorative King plates and portraits on their former civil rights activists, this was a hard strike. They didn't like that critique from John Williams. And Williams had another saying. He was said that, "I am still angry, but you can't just be angry all the time." He never lost his edge in terms of his writing, but he chose to kind of soften it a little bit when he wrote a book called The Junior Bachelor Society. In his obituary for Williams, the New York Times' William Grimes described it as an unexpectedly heartwarming story about a group of middle-aged black men who returned to their hometown to honor their football coach and mentor. Eventually, NBC would later turn that into a miniseries. And in that miniseries, it was re-entitled "The Sophisticated Gents." And I had a chance to see that that production. Very well done. UCLA's Richard Yarborough says Williams found himself in the odd in-between position, younger than Wright and Baldwin, but older than Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Ishmael Reed, because he chose not to make himself visible on the lecture circuit. And as talking head, John Williams did not receive as much prominence as many critics think that he deserved. His legacy will be intellectual rigor, his insightful look at human psychology, and his fearlessness in addressing issues of race and creativity. Writing about race and about the intractability of racism would prove corrosive for some writers. Not John Williams. He says, "I'm still angry," he once told Publishers Weekly, "but you can't just be angry all the time." John Williams. And I thought that he was an appropriate presentation for us here tonight, because we're talking about mental slavery and we're looking at some of the things that prohibit us. And I thought what was very interesting was the piece that he did on King, King really felt that whites were open up, that they were capable of having some kind of passion, compassion, particularly if they chose not to be violent. And as you know, that did not work. And so I thought maybe that would be a good subject to talk about and to look at as well. I'm going to take a quick break. Okay, I understand that they are hearing me now. I don't know what happened before. I was told that I'm not here. So I won't take a quick break. So I want to go right into our dialogue. But anyway, John Williams, that was a key individual that I thought from the 60s. We've been doing recently, like last week we talked about radical activism, and we've been looking at people who have done that using various mediums. And obviously writing was clearly one of those mediums that was used to do that, and looking at that. And then the subject of mental slavery has always been written about and always been looked at from different perspectives. And I'm going to talk about some of the books that have been out there and maybe kind of talk to you a little bit about what they are and what some of those are. But I want to get on into the subject of this whole thing of mental slavery, because first of all, we need to understand it. I mean, we know that, and I'm not assaulting your intelligence, that I think that we all understand that chattel slavery was a very difficult system of war and captivity. But I think the key piece that we need to understand, and I think sometimes African Americans don't clearly understand it this way, is that slavery was an act of war. We are at war with European nations and the Arab world. when the Europeans and the Arabs, as PLO Lumumba said, when they went to the shores of Africa, they went as a war mechanism. They went to capture and to kill, if they would. That is an act of war. And the reason that I stress that is because there are certain factors that go along of the declaration of a war. And trust me, when they went in, the Africans fought them back. It's just that the method, it was by surprise, like anything, just like America got caught by surprise by the Japanese. And the only difference, the Americans had weapons, but the art of surprise caught them off guard. And as a result of that, the Japanese were able to make a headway into that based on the Pearl Harbor situation. So when you're caught by surprise, sometimes it does have a devastating effect. And so Africans were invaded, and Africa was invaded. People were taken out. They were uprooted. And that's what I'd like to call it. I like to call it uprooting. And by using that, that helps us explain and understand a little bit more of the impact psychologically that's going to have on people. And when I mean uprooted, what I mean is that you are yanked, just like a tree would be yanked from the ground by its roots, yanked out of the soil. Which means that the essence that the tree has to feed on, those roots suck from the earth. Those roots are aligned with the type of soil in that earth. If you were to take a pineapple plant, from yank that out of the ground, and try to take it somewhere else, and attempt to grow it. It's not going to have the same effect if it was being grown in soil that is relative to Hawaii and some of those southern regions of the world where they grow pineapples. So that's the difference about uprooting. Uprooting, you are yanked out of the soil in which you grow and you nourish, and you are able to produce in positive and productive ways. The Africans were yanked from that. And then were taken to a strange land and attempted to be replanted into soil and environments that they had nothing about. Africans were not used to producing out of cold weather temperatures and other factors. And so that becomes a devastating act in doing that. You can imagine being somewhere, you out in your yard doing some things and you're working, and all of a sudden somebody comes up and throws a bag over your head, grabs you and puts you in a trunk of a car or back of a truck and drives you away, puts you on a plane and ships you to some far place you know nothing about, and then you are out and you are forced to do. You left everything behind you. You have nothing. You bring nothing with you, obviously. And so I want to make sure that that's clear, because that is the act of war. That's done. So anyway, those who study and try to understand what has happened under this banner have labeled it several things. They labeled it post-traumatic slave syndrome. Dr. Bobby Wright has called it menticide. Then there's the concept of internalized oppression. And then there are those who call it mental slavery. And it has several definitions. And again, whatever your choices are in order to study this, obviously you choose the one that best suits your understanding of the system. I choose to use mental slavery and menticide. I'm with both of those. And Dr. Bobby Wright, I understand the work that he did, and we're going to talk a little bit about Dr. Wright's work and how that works. But many African-centered thinkers have taken steps to identify the symptoms of these terms in order to develop an agenda or a curriculum that can be used for healing. And that's the bottom line to this discussion. We have to heal from this. And we've got to do it ourselves. As Bob Marley has said, actually it's Marcus Garvey's quote, he says, we are going to emancipate ourselves from mental slavery, because whilst others might free the body, none but ourselves can free the mind. None but ourselves can free the mind. Mind is your only ruler, according to Garber. It's sovereign. The man who is not able to develop and use his mind is bound to be the slave of the other man who uses his mind. This is the words of Marcus Scott. And as a result of that, Bob Marley took those words and wrote the redemption song that is so familiar to all of us. So our focus today is to talk a little bit about that. And we're going to be specific, and we are going to go directly to some of the proven writers, some of those who are in the profession of psychology and who have identified what some of the symptoms of this mental slavery, this whole idea of menticide, internalized oppression is. And we're gonna look at those steps, and then we're going to ask ourselves what possible programming can be done to heal from this. I have a very good friend who wrote a book called Recapturing the African Mind, and there have been many of them like that, Recapturing the African Mind. We know the books that have been written by Dr. Naeem Akbar, dealing with the subject matter. Francis Crest Wilson has addressed this. Now, they are psychiatrists and psychologists, so they do have a professional wing to this. A lot of us don't have that background that they have, but still, you know, it's relevant for us to look at it because it affects us. We all suffer from some of these things. I don't think there's anybody that I know that's immune from some of these particular symptoms that we are talking about. So the whole idea then is for us to take a look and understand. Now, as I've said to you each week, the goal and objective here at the Black Reality Think Tank is to understand the past, dissect the present, and support implementing a meaningful future. And that's what we want to do here with this subject. The first one is that word, this internalized oppression. Now, one of the organizations that has identified that says that the idea is that oppression is hatred of one group toward another group. And usually what it is upheld by public policy and private actions. So when a police officer continually shoots black males, there is a public policy programming that supports that. Even though they may be looked at or charged or end up having to talk to a court or something, most of the time they walk away free. And obviously relating to the fact that that is supported by somebody, by a system, by ideology. So when one group of persons is the object of the target of systematic oppression over long periods of times, it then begins to create what we call miseducation, misinformation, subjugation, and lies begin to be normal, routine, customary, and acceptable to members of the group who are discriminated against. The normal process in this, all of this, though, is what they call internalized oppression. And so the persons who are targets of the hatred and often believe that lie, that they are inferior, and that's what they're told, that they're inferior, they're not worthy of others, and they're treated that way, and they're promoted in everything that they do that they are inferior, that becomes a problem because then they begin to internalize that. And they do believe, just like I've heard people say when parents are working with their children, they call their children stupid and dumb, and you ain't worth this and you ain't worth that. Eventually, the child internalizes that, and they believe that lie. And obviously, it's not true because they are worth something. And so we've always been encouraged. So that's the internalized oppression. Now, the mental side, as I said, is the work of the great Dr. Bobby Wright, was a psychologist, and Dr. Conrad Wuerl, who is himself a sociologist, historian, has written extensively about Bobby Wright's work. Dr. Bobby Wright wrote a book called Breaking the Psychological Chains of White Supremacy, and he talked about vehemently the whole idea of menticide. He wrote a paper called Menticide, the Ultimate Threat to the Black Race. And he defined menticide. Dr. Wright explains that it is the deliberate and systematic destruction of a person or a group's mind, which may give a clue to why the black race after developing such an advanced civilization, has for the last 400 years been assisted in his own destruction and near total subjugation of Africa by foreign invaders? And you gotta ask that question. Dr. Chancellor Williams, as a historian, asked that whole idea about the African destruction and what happened. You know, we are such a great people, and we created powerful civilization, powerful empires that last thousands of years. How in the world did we lose that? What happened? What was the process of the destruction? And Dr. Chancellor Williams gets into that himself in his book, and there are others who write about that destruction. And basically, it comes within. It's sometimes, most of it is an internal specifics, but it's created by an environment from an outsider's. But the specific destruction happens from inside. And I think one of the things that we have to be clear about is that sometimes what we relegate to be menticide or mental slavery is not really that. Like, for instance, let me give you an example. If somebody is an alcoholic or a drug addict, that doesn't necessarily have to come from mental slavery. Now, mental slavery creates the environment sometimes that causes that. But it's not the direct results of sometimes being an alcoholic or being there. So when we talk about mental slavery, we're not talking about curing alcoholism or curing drug addiction. We're talking about curing the idea that creates the need to do these things. Like, for instance, when somebody goes to court and the judge asks them, look at their record, and they may have stolen some money. And they say, well, why did you steal the money? Well, I'm an alcoholic. And then most of the times, what the court will do as a solution is assign them to a drug and alcohol program. Now, is the drug and alcohol program going to stop the stealing? Is that going to kill that? You have to first ask what drove them to that point. And that's usually not done, particularly when it comes to us. And so we are quickly thrown into these quick programs, makeshift programs, drug and alcohol. And I'm not saying that that's not important to do that, but I'm just saying that's not going to be the panacea for changing that person's lifestyle and mentality. Because eventually down the line, if they have families, the family is destroyed by all of that, regardless of what healing has done or taken place from the beginning. So and there are other things as well that we can talk about in doing it the same way and looking at how that works. So Dr. Wright's whole question of menticide, and I think one of the reasons that he does, he says that the key points that were described by Dr. Wright deals with basically oppressive psychological conditions of African people, systematic refusal to have access to equal employment, housing, being able to access, and that's not giving people anything. A lot of times all you need is access to get to things that we need to do, just like Europeans did. When Europeans came to this country, they were given land. They were given the land, not bought it. They were given it. You know, there's a whole history of land grants that were given individually to Europeans to go and raise food and farming and to grow food and do with it. And they did it, and they provided incomes for their families. It was a struggle. We're not saying it was easy, but that's the deal. At least they had access to it, whereas Africans did not have that. We did not have access to land development. There were acquisitions of land that Africans got from being on the plantations. The planters a lot of times bequeath land to some of the Africans who were held in captivity by them. Most of them, a lot of them were their children that they had birthed through the rape of the mothers. And so they were given land. But then quickly after slavery, within the next 10 years after slavery, they started taking it back and did not want them to be able to have access to that. So Dr. Wright's piece is about the whole idea of that systematic public policy program of oppressing people, of African people, and then creating mechanisms to ensure that it sticks, such as prisons and things like that. So that was given or put into the equation where that became a very horrible system, and the damage it would do, not only to the persons incarcerated, but to the families of people who were trying to live. And then at the conclusion of slavery, things like the sharecropping system, the whole idea around that, and then lynchings and the whole disrespect and the continuous effort of interjecting this idea that the African was negative. And that's the mental side that he talks about. That's killing the mind. And you do that every day, all the time. You do that. I was just reading an article a couple of days ago where this school right here in Georgia was making the children put up blackface. I didn't go all the way totally into it, but it was that was a horrible thing. And you see that in a lot of cases, the educational system, poor education system, where learning, and they're told that they're dumb and they're stupid, and you're never going to learn anything. And then books like The Bell Curve that was written talking about blacks can't learn at the same level of whites. You got to be kidding me. But clearly, you know, a book like that would be written and then funded by an organization that claims it's designed to help people, but basically it's just an organization based around the John Birch Society, which I call the pinstripe, wingtip shoes wearing Klansmen. But anyway, those things are implicated every day. Being told you can't go to this school because you don't qualify, you know, your grades are not up to par, you know, creating tests and systems of testing your psychology that basically are incorrect. And so Dr. Bobby Wright dealt with that mental side piece coming from that perspective. And then the mental slavery version, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through these definitions, and then I'm going to kind of open up our lines and let folk talk about a little bit about what their understanding and some of their experience. But anyway, the whole idea of the mental slavery, again, it's coming. This one comes obviously from a more medical perspective. Now, as you know, the profession of psychology and psychiatry. This is a system of study, and we've always fared very terribly in that process. There's a book called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, and it's a part of the American Psychiatric Association. And what this book does is it codifies and characterizes the various types of mental illnesses and mental disorders, and it defines that. And they define a mental disorder as a psychological pattern or an anomaly potentially reflected in behavior which is not considered part of normal development in a person's culture. And one of the first problems I got with that is what's normal? But anyway, it says that mental disorders are generally defined by a combination of how a person feels, acts, thinks, or perceives. And so that becomes codified in that book. And then what can happen is that there are people in the profession, psychiatry, psychologists, who can treat that. And they can bill health plans and governmental agencies, health agencies, and so forth as that. If that is not in there, you can't bill. And there's nothing in the DSM for racism, internalized depression, not in that way, post-traumatic slave syndrome, and all of those are not included in that diagnostic manual. So therefore, somebody could treat that, but you can't pay for it. It can't be billed by insurance. And so the idea then is that mental slavery, internalized depression, mental side, none of those are a part of that. So whatever studies can be done to really define it just can't happen out of that. So if someone, for instance, let me just talk about it. So if you have a problem, like, for instance, again, let's go back to alcohol. And so despite all the empty alcohol bottles and credit card buddies that go on your balances, the gambling debts and all that stuff that you require, if it's not in the manual, you're not sick. So it doesn't matter. Things like anorexia, bulimia, and some of those kind of conditions are considered to be problems. Bipolar, agoraphobia, those kinds of things can do that. But now when you get down to a person suffering by bleaching their skin and trying to turn themselves white, or either trying to sit in a beauty salon and get their hair fried and dyed so they look like white people, that's not a problem. That's not a disease. That's not a condition. And so it's not listed as that way. So if a mother rejects her child, is that not listed under mental condition? That's the question you would ask. If someone acts outside of their own self-interest, but in the self-interest of another person, clearly that's something wrong with the brain. The brain is doing something there. And that is exactly how mental slavery should be treated, but it's not. When we go out to the optometrist and buy blue eye lens, and we put blue pupils in our eyes because we want to have blue eyes like Caucasians, or like I said, fry and dye your hair, or go sit up in some kind of a salon and get our skin whitened so that we can look like we're white. According to the psychiatry profession, there's nothing wrong with that. But clearly, we all know that there's something is not operating properly behind that kind of behavior. So that's the problem with identifying and codifying all of these terms. So what we as a community has to do is we have to go on and consider and outline what we think they are, and then go from there and operate in that manner in terms of our own self-educating system. And that's one of the other problems. We don't have a self-educating system, and create curriculums that can address some of these issues. Dr. Asa Hilliard, who is a psychologist, has done a magnificent job of sort of lining up some of those symptoms that he wants to look at. And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to use Dr. Hilliard's suggestions of what some of the things that reflect mental slavery are, what they are. And then we're going to take those and kind of just do it, because this is a vast subject. There's no way we can cover all of this. But we're going to hone in to Dr. Hilliard, because I respect and itemize his work. He was very African-centered. He did a lot of work in terms of black psychiatry. He was a psychologist. He was an educational psychologist here in Georgia. And he did a lot of work, wrote a lot of books, went to Africa, traveled. So he had a real good viewpoint that, you know, we can go from. So I'm going to view his ideas, and then from there we will begin to make some suggestions on how one might heal using the points that he raises. And so what I'm going to do is first list the five of them. We're going to take a break, and then I'm going to come back and open up the lines so that we can then begin to talk about that. So here are the things that he has identified as problem areas. Number one, genetic low self-esteem, and particularly in children. A lot of children can't look you in the face and talk to you. A lot of adults can't do that. They have a tendency to look down when they're talking to you. You ask them to shake their hands, they give you a very weak handshake. There's no confidence in their handshake. They have no confidence in themselves. You ask them who they are. I don't know. My name is Joe. Well, that's your name, but who are you? I don't know. What do you mean? What do you mean, who am I? We operated a prison program in Wisconsin. And we were working with adult inmates who had first-time offenders for a drug program. And this was a program where we were going in trying to help them do this very same thing, raise their self-esteem. And I remember we did what I called a mirror test. I had a mirror test. And what I did is that we were had about, it was about 20 inmates. And I said, I'm getting ready to show you all a picture of the of one of the greatest people on the planet Earth. I said, who you think that is? And they started saying, Martin Luther King. That was the biggest one. Some said Jackie Robinson. I had one guy said Bill Clinton, because that was at during the time when the Clinton administration. Somebody said George Washington. And these were all African Americans now. And but nobody said what I wanted to hear them say. And I gave the mirror to the first person. I said, who is that? And they said, it's me, but I ain't great. I'm not great. I said, but you have value. You have something. There's something that you do that is great. Now I'm in prison. I'm in the penitentiary. I can't, how am I great? And so there was a big discussion with each person. So I said, I want you to look at that mirror and tell me what you see. You know, and I heard some of the guys say, man, I don't want to do this. What I don't see, I see me. I said, well, who is that? What do you mean, who is that? I don't know who that is. It's me. It's George. George, that's me. Well, anyway, they were not able to articulate a value system of themselves and based on what they see. And I had one guy who wanted to argue with me, and he was beginning to get real belligerent with me about that. Man, what are we going to do this BS for? I mean, what has this got to do with anything? I thought you was going to come out here and tell us about how to get jobs when we get out of prison. I said, well, how are you going to get a job if you don't have the confidence to tell an employer who you are? Well, I mean, they don't ask all that. You know, they just want to know what experience you got. But anyway, and it got so he got so loud about it that one of the security staff had to come over and make sure that everything was all right. Genetic low self-esteem. That is what number one. Number two, cultural confusion. Cultural confusion. How many people do we see walking around with things identified in terms of baseball teams and football teams, and I'm an Atlanta Braves shirt or something like that. That seems to be a cultural confusion, or either they are all tied into. I know a young man that loves rock stars. He loves people like the Doors, and he likes. I don't know all the name of these rock groups, but that one called Insane Clowns or something like that. And he's African American. He loves that. Well, he's confused about his culture. A culture identifies who you are and what you do and what's in your bloodline and your history. And the Insane Clowns rock group does not identify us and our culture and our history. And there's so many other things. Like I have people, you ask them, I see sometime on Facebook, they ask people, what's your favorite three movies that you've ever seen? And I've seen people write, Gone with the Wind. You know, come on, man. And some of the other things that like that. You're confused about who you are, where you come from, and what you're doing, and how that should be seen by yourself. And I mean, there are other examples of that too as well, but I just wanted to kind of talk about what cultural confusion is, and obviously our dressing and our clothing. And even as Dr. Amos Wilson says, you know, the fact of what we call ourselves, our names, and things like that, the fact that we still hold on to our European names and we dress in European clothes. And many of us are guilty of that. I'm guilty of that. I haven't changed my name. I do wear African clothes occasionally. But again, that's an issue, and I want to do better at that. I want to be able to start wearing more African clothes and doing more things in that way, because, I mean, I guess there is some confusion in my own self, and I'm first to admit that. So I'm not so naive that I won't understand that. But that's what we've got, and we got to be honest with ourselves. We're doing that. Dr. Hilliard lists number three, cultural misalignment. Cultural misalignment. African men didn't beat their wives. They don't do that. They don't rape their kids. They don't have sex with their daughters. Yeah, that's a misalignment. Men don't leave their children to be raised by their mothers without them being there. That's a problem. Where's that coming from? What makes you do that? You know, why do you walk out when the mother of your child is pregnant and you walk out on her? You don't have sex with anybody just for the sake of feeling good. That's a cultural misalignment. And so that's number three. Number four, self-hatred. A lot of us hate ourselves. We don't like our colors, so therefore we dye our skin. We don't like our hair, we try to straighten it. We don't like our eyes, we go out and add other stuff. That's self-hatred. We don't like ourselves. And the fact that we don't like ourselves, we don't like other people we see. Man, I can't stand them N-I-G-G-R-S. Man, I do this. They make me sick. I can't stand that stuff. You know that, and we create that dialogue in our own minds because we hate ourselves. And so therefore we pass that on to our brothers and sisters. I don't want to be with them N-I-G-E-R-S. They ain't about it. S-H-I-T. You know, get out of my face, nigga. I don't want to deal with you. Self-hatred. Number five, spiritual indifference. And that's a big one. Spiritual indifference. When Africans came to the New World, they were Igbo, Wolof, Yoruba, and other forms of traditional African. Mende, and some of the other African understanding. Their gods were African gods. Their gods were Shango, Ogun. They were worshiping gods that they understood in terms of the creation who would be with them always at all time. They were worshiping gods who connected them to the universe, to the earth. And so therefore their prayers and their conscientiousness was guided by what was traditional. Christianity and Islam was the religion of the invaders. The Arabs would come in under Islam and would force the Africans through a system of all kind of means, not always all violent. They did it through money and opportunities, you know, and things like that. And then Christianity would come later, in particular when the English got involved. There were five European nations that embarked, mainly were in the slave trade. That was the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, and the English. And that was also the order in which they were into the trade and at the height they were in. So the first were the Portuguese. The Portuguese, many argue, were Moors. There were a lot of Moors that were involved with them. Dr. John Henry Clark clearly points out that the Moors were a very big part of the enslavement of African people. And that's based on, and the Moor concept is just strictly based on skin color. The word Moor means black. So anyway, that's a whole other discussion. But then the Spanish. And then after the Spanish, the French. And then the Dutch. And then eventually the English. The English would be the most cruel version of slavery. Slavery exists at the beginning of the world. You know, even Africans were involved in some form of that, of bondage and captivity based on war and so forth and fighting. But what the English would do would go to a level of making captives property. Which is why we call it chattel slavery. And so that spiritual indifference is the cause of some of the challenges we now have here. Those who subscribe to Christianity and the New Testament know that the New Testament is understanding of the story of Jesus. And you were taught that Jesus would take care of all of your troubles and that you would be healed from Jesus. So don't try to do everything on your own. Just let God take care of it. And in the end, you know, during the resurrection, you'll go back and you'll be okay. And there's a lot more to that. But that's a real problem. So in some cases, the African put down their weapons and turned to that ideology, and it was totally different. And right now, even in traditional Africa, they are supporting that system, particularly among countries like Nigeria, heavy Christian area. And they leave all of their troubles to be solved by Jesus in the hereafter. And that's a real problem when it comes to that. But anyway, those are the five differences. Those are the five impacts from slavery that we see today. Now, there are others. Amos Wilson has identified, he had identified, I think the Atlanta Black Star had a list of five things that came from Dr. Wilson. Clothes, tongue, food, some of the cultural things. Those are things that are indications that we have a problem with mental slavery because we are not able to culturally align with our history. And so therefore, that's that. And I guess that runs the gamut of even those in the motherland. I'll never forget, remember when I first saw the African king, what is it, from the southern part of Africa, I just can't think of it right this minute, but he was dressed in a pinstripe double-breasted suit with wingtip shoes and a lion cloth draped around him, which in the movie Coming to America, the outfit that James Earl Jones had on came from him. The Zulu king. The real Zulu king was dressed in that. He had obviously been influenced by the English. And most of those Mobutu from Africa didn't dress in African clothes, per se. And we know his whole thing. George Bush was his daddy, he said. And so he did that. But anyway, those are the things that we are looking at. So we want to talk about the audience. We want to ask our listening audience to give their input now and just kind of help us to figure out how to begin to pull together what might possibly be a policy to heal, particularly among our children. Are we going to be able to get our sons to stop going out here paying $300 for a pair of sneakers? That has nothing to do with anything. As you know, they do that. So let's take a quick break. You're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We're here every Tuesday from 8 to 10 o'clock. And we are here a part of timeforanawakening.com, which is on the network of blacktalkradionetwork.com. This program is sponsored by Motherland Media. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the other programs that do air on this network. But let's take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and take up this subject.
Oh,
Okay, good afternoon. You're still listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. As I said earlier, we are here every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We're dealing with a subject that is complex in a lot of ways. We are trying to look at it in terms of solution and ideas and how to manage those and develop agendas and programs. So I'm going to start off with a guest that I think that this is who it is. This is a young lady who is a very personal friend, and that I know she is working with a group out of North Carolina. We're working particularly on addressing internalized oppression. And they're doing it not only from just a discussion format, they're doing it in a clinical way. And so hopefully this is her. I'm going to bring her on. She's at 336-621. Good afternoon, caller.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Can you hear me, Dr. Rogers?
Yes, I can. I can hear you well. How are you today?
I'm okay. How are you?
Great. I'm glad you turned in. Help us out with this internalized oppression and what may possibly be a way that we can do some healing agendas to operate from. Can you just shed light on what you are doing and what the community of people who are working on that are doing?
Well, I actually called in. I literally just called in, so I didn't even hear the first part of this show.
Okay.
I just got home and got your message.
So, okay, good.
I'm wondering if you can get somebody else to talk and then get back to me in about 5 minutes so I can kind of catch up. Would that work?
Well, that'll work, but can you, is there a way possible that maybe you can just tell us what internalized oppression means for you, and then I can go to somebody else and we can come back to you as it relates to decisions. How do you all see that definition?
Well, internalized oppression is pretty much what the words say in terms of definition, is when a group of people, because usually groups of people are oppressed, internalize the treatment, the abuses, the terrorizing, all the things that comes along that go with oppression. When we internalize that treatment and the messages that the treatment sends, that treatment and internalization becomes a part of our belief system. So, example, very common example, the dark skin. All right, the dark-skinned brothers and sisters across the diaspora, mm-hmm. but to focus here in America, very dark-skinned ones of us are usually, unfortunately, treated worse than the lighter-skinned by their own family members,
right.
The community. Wherever they go, they get the message that because of the darkness, the high melanation of their skin, that they are literally ugly, less desirable, have very little value. People internalize that message because of white oppression, because white oppression says, you know, black is ugly, black is bad, black is dumb. And after years and years and centuries of hearing these messages, then people internalize it, which means it becomes a part of their belief system deep inside. And it goes deep inside the subconscious mind. So oftentimes when people, if you ask a person how you feel about being dark-skinned, they don't want to say that I feel like I'm ugly, but they will tell you, I've been told this all my life,
mm-hmm.
and this is all I've seen.
Right.
And it becomes a part of their belief system. So that's how deep it is.
It is, right. Okay.
It literally lodges itself in the subconscious mind.
Okay. Well, I'm going to come back to you because I want you to talk about some of those healing circles that you all are doing. I'll give you a chance to kind of get yourself together, and I'll go to some other folk, and I'll be back to you in just a few minutes. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
Because I hope that made sense.
All right. It does. Thank you. Okay. Okay, let's go over to 267. I'm not sure if this 267 333 and see if there's a message from that caller. Good evening, caller. This is the Black.
Yes, Dr. Rogers. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you called.
Yeah, and I called last week, the week before that.
You sure did.
I look forward to call every Tuesday this time. Trust
I appreciate
me.
It. I really appreciate
it's always
it.
A pleasure.
Okay.
Yes. And I'm going to tell you, Dr. Rogers, you talk so much about so many good things on so many subjects. I'm trying to pick the ones that are best, and they're all good. And we only have so much time, you know. But I'm going to say this. You had mentioned Martin Luther King and whether or not he thought that the white man could be changed. Well,
yeah.
I remember from reading the letter that he wrote from Birmingham, where he had written down where he felt as though that the white man was an incurable devil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you this, that he met a man during his life who was able to break the psychology of the white man, and that was Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
It is a shame that those two did not live and share together their knowledge. As soon as they met, one was assassinated, the other one was assassinated not too long after that. But I think what Elijah Muhammad did for Malcolm X in breaking the psychology of the white man and by giving him the knowledge of himself,
mm-hmm.
which put him up psychologically, because basically in America, we are healthy people as African Americans. We got to sometimes change our diet and plenty of exercise. But genetically, we are a very sound race.
Yes.
So most of our problems, Dr. Rogers, are psychologically.
Yes.
Are psychological. And you mentioned a man by the name of Naeem Akbar, who also was from the Nation of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book, a pamphlet, I believe, called The Psychological Chains of Slavery. And
mm-hmm.
that pamphlet, sir, I had it in the 80s. I had to search for it amongst my libraries and my archives, and I need to pull it back up because you point me in a direction I should be going into, because what we're dealing with today
right.
is the psychology of the white man, how we must break it. The thing is, how do we break his psychology to liberate him? That's mm-hmm. the other side. But I want to say this to you, Dr. Rogers. You're in Atlanta at this present time, and you're in Georgia, is that correct?
Yeah, in Georgia, right. I'm near about 20 okay. miles from Atlanta, from the city of Atlanta. Mm-hmm.
Very good. You dropped something on me about studying Du Bois Lewis at Clark Atlanta University. I've been doing it.
Right.
And you've helped me to go in the direction that I want. And I looked at what he did with conferences and what he did with the Negro problem and how he increased the sociology and economics and history department.
Right.
But I also want to say this to you, sir, that I also did a little bit more research and coming about, because after he did the Philadelphia Negro, he was in Philadelphia, and he lived in a ward in Philadelphia. It was a black ward at one time. He left Philadelphia, and he went to Wilberforce first.
That's right.
And I found that at Wilberforce, he taught a lot of the classics. And, you know, he, of course, him being a Fish graduate, and eventually going to the University of Berlin, and the scholarship money ran out, he winds up at Harvard. I know he studied under the James brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure he taught that pretty well when it came to the classics. But I think that his expertise was sociology. And I believe that he spread his wing. Like you said, his baby was Clark Atlanta University.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to say to you, sir, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I know you'll come behind me and like cross the T's and dot the I's. I'm going to say this to you, sir,
mm-hmm.
that is, I was told from a relative of mine who father graduated from Clark, and he said that unfortunately when King was assassinated, that after they brought him to the Undertaker from coming from the Lane Hotel, is it true that his body laid rest for a certain amount of time at Clark?
Dr. King?
At Clark? Or, yeah. Yes. Or did they take it to Morehouse first? Tell me about that.
I'm not sure. I don't think it went. I may be wrong, but I don't think it went to Clark Atlanta. I know that there, you know, because one of the problems is that when King was killed, you know, there was no money to bury him, and Harry Belafonte put up the money to have his funeral and to pay for those expenses that occurred. I have read that. I've actually seen that written I mean, I even heard Harry Belafonte say that. And I'm sure that others contributed to it as well. But he put up the bulk of the money. So I'm not sure if it laid rest. I would think that it would lay rest more in Morehouse than it would, because he was a Morehouse man, very clearly.
Yes, he was.
And he graduated from Morehouse, not Clark Atlanta.
That's correct.
Right. And
but that area where Bennett is and Clark is and Morehouse and Spelman, they're all like across the street and down the street.
Well, yeah, it's called, you know, it's called the Atlanta University System. It's all of them there, Clark, Morehouse, Spelman, and at one time, Marsh Brown. Marsh Brown was a very active school. You know, it's now since closed down. They lost their accreditation. And matter of fact, the buildings are up for sale. But those were the hubs. That was the intellectual center. And then you had the theological center, the Interdenominational Theological Center, which is called ITC, is right there and there. So you got five universities sitting right there in that circle of Atlanta. You can go right over there in the east point of Georgia, and they're all right there together, all of them, right there.
You call that the intellectual center, sir?
I would definitely think that, because a lot of it had to do with people like a Du Bois and some of the others who were being involved. They, you know, really, when you look at it, the influences with that were a lot of religious organizations were a part of that, because as I indicated earlier, Clark Atlanta had a lot to do with the Presbyterians. I don't know if you're aware of the Presbyterians were heavily into black community work. You know, now, not that they were pro-black, but they had a lot to do with going into the black community. So there's a lot of Presbyterian churches, particularly in Georgia, that are African American. Never mind the Baptists. I'm talking Presbyterian. And then the United Methodists. The United Methodists also was very active in setting up those universities, a lot of them going in there. And obviously, if they set them up, they're going to create the curriculum. And that curriculum is going to be Christian in a lot of aspects, and it's going to have a Eurocentric persuasion to it. And I think if you go in and look at some of those curriculums, so that's why, for instance, Du Bois would teach the classics. They would talk about Shakespeare and Socrates and, you know, look at all the Greek theology, you know, that's a part of that. And the Tuskegee Institute problem. Booker T. Washington said that, well, you know, black folk don't need to learn about Shakespeare until they first learn how to make shoes and make a house and build things, you know. So that's how that clashed. But no, I think Dr. King if his body went anywhere, it would have went to Morehouse and not Clark Atlanta. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. And what's the gentleman's name? Again, his name is John Williams.
John Williams. Oh, yeah. Please read John Williams. And particularly The Man That Cried I Am. You know, that's a dynamic piece of literature. And he was very radical. Like I said, you know, he was talking about change. And when he created that document called the King Alfred Plan, I mean, it was realistic. And there probably was a plan like that. It just probably wasn't called the King Alfred. The COINTELPRO document is very similar to the King Alfred Plan. And King Alfred was an English king that was cruel. And he was named after him. So John Williams was really at the cutting edge of doing some very radical work in terms of that time frame.
Okay, so the man I cried I am, and also the King Alfred Plan. Correct?
Right, the man who cried I am, and the King Alfred Plan is in his book. It's in that book,
okay.
The Man Who Cried I Am. He talks about a plan that Europeans were going to do to destroy black people, and like I said, that's probably true, but he just didn't call it that.
Okay, I will say this, sir. Uh-huh. One thing that I did look up, that you told me to look up, was Timothy Fortune.
Oh, yeah, T. Thomas Fortune.
Yes, I do. And I saw where he assisted Dr. Washington.
Yes, sir.
In his writings, and also he's just also Marcus Garvey.
And Marcus Garvey, that's right.
I'm enjoying reading what I know about the man, because he's dying in Philadelphia.
Right. And that's a powerful time. That was a powerful time in black life and black culture. Like I said, you had all of those contemporaries working together. You had some of the most powerful men and women African-American men and women on the planet Earth working together between the between those two world wars. And they were coming up with ideas and agendas to try to implement change. The problem was, and this is one of the arguments that we can really kind of clearly look at, is that a lot of what they were doing, they had faith that white folks would change and would eventually be open. But that we now know in 2018 that was not the case. And so that's
right. You said there were some white folks of what?
They laid out hope that whites would change, that they would be open and that they would be accepted.
Oh yeah. Sure. Yeah. Right. And that was an illusion.
And it was. And don't for people that first thing they do is holler, well, we had a black president, that
right.
means nothing. You know, but anyway, they would try that. So, right.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your call.
John Williams. Is that correct?
John Williams, the man who cried, I am. Yes.
Okay.
All right. Have a good day. I'll talk to you. Please listen next week. Okay.
Right. Till next week, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
225-288. Did you have a comment or question, caller?
Well, doctor, I can make several comments that addresses the everything you've talked about.
Please
but
do.
Just to sort of summarize, what you've said so far for those who come in late and so on. On the one hand, you've got Asa Hilliard, who identified the five elements of menticide or mental slavery,
right?
Deficient self-esteem, cultural confusion, self-hatred, cultural misalignment, and spiritual indifference.
And self-hatred.
Self-hatred, right? That was mentioned. And then you talked that there are three variations of this this mental slavery. It manifests itself in internalized depression, which Sister Manishiwa points out to us that it's sort of the internalization of something externally imposed upon you.
Right.
And then you talked about menticide, this ideal of discouraging your self-confidence.
Right.
Now, you mentioned something else. You talked about the APA and the fact that these conditions are not in their manual, and as a result, you can't, they can't be insured, that you can't be billed for them and so on. But let me say that in October of this year, mm-hmm. The Association of Black Psychologists mm-hmm. are going to have their 50th anniversary.
Right.
And they've been for the last 50 years, they walked out of the APA 50 years ago. And for 50 years, they've been developing a black psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, and so they actually address everything that you're talking about. In particular, what they say is that three-fourths of African people are Bantu Congo people, and that therefore, if you use the Bantu Congo cosmology and spiritual system as a basis, you can begin to address some of the issues. And in particular, what he says is that, first of all, the objective is to move from a black consciousness to an African consciousness.
Right.
And then he tells us what that African consciousness is. He says, really, to understand it, we need to understand the one drop rule as it was applied in America versus as it was applied in Africa or in Haiti. In other words, when you're in places where black people are the minority, the one drop rule means that you're black and that you can never be white.
Right.
When you're in places where black people are the majority, like in Haiti or in Africa, then the one drop rule means that you're white. And so the goal for Africans in Africa was the goal to aspire to be white. The problem for blacks in America was the dehumanization problem that in other words, the Africans in Africa were assumed to be human, but you can be better than a human. You can be a white human. And mm-hmm. so their goal was to become white. The Africans in America, the argument was that if you were human, we wouldn't be treating you the way we're treating you. So obviously you're not human. you're really subhuman, and so mm-hmm. the objective was to go there. But now let's go further and talk about what's happening today, what has been done to address this.
Okay.
Stokely Carmichael, in his book Black Power, talks about institutionalized racism. That's a direct addressing of the externalized oppression, which leads to internalized oppression. And that project has been carried on by groups since then. So it's been going on all over the place.
Okay.
Martin Luther King, when he talks about the revaluation of values and so on, that once again is a critique of the notion that somehow or another that white people are the leaders, the spiritual leaders in the world. When you see that the president of Ghana, President Addo, in December of 2017, in front of President Macron, telling him we don't need your aid and that we can do it for ourselves. What that represents is the taking off of those mental shackles and the beginning of the sort of the reemergence of the whole people.
Okay.
So I think that pretty much wraps the. The final thing I would just mention.
Okay.
You talked about the fact that Dr. King, John Williams' critique of Dr. King was that his beloved community model was naive. Now let me say this: that I approve of the beloved community model. Mm-hmm. I just don't approve of Dr. King's version of it. To sort of summarize the difference. The Dr. King's version of the beloved community model reminds me of a zoo where you have these kind of captive people, these captive creatures, and then they just have to figure out a way to, live among you.
Okay.
The alternative, the real beloved community model is a rainforest. It's a place where there are different kind of creatures who are doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the best analogy for a beloved community is the relationship between you and other families that, that are friends of yours. That you're not in their family running their house and they're not in your family running your house, but nevertheless, you have some harmonious relationships once you get outside outside in the community. Well,
yeah,
that's what a beloved community is.
Okay,
it enables
that.
The coexistence of mm-hmm. difference, not
right.
the, not the homogenization of difference.
Right.
And I
do agree with the looking at the Association of Black Psychologists, because I did look at their website as well, and I was trying to find where some of their research is going, and you're right, it does embrace a lot of what we are talking about, because you got folk like Wade Nobles and others and the Cabones.
Well, it's Wade Nobles and the whole group. They have slam dunked. I mean, in other words,
right.
they have. They're moving the ball on that.
Yeah, I agree.
The whole
agree.
Project of any kind of black reemergence as a people, that's coming from the thinking, obviously, from, Diop and the intellectual progenitors, but it is certainly coming from the work that they've done.
Right.
Naim Akbar is an example. Asa Hilliard. I mean, these are examples. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, stay on. I definitely always appreciate your input. I got a bunch of other folk here on the line I'm going to try to get to because time's moving real fast. I've got the brother, and he's from Newport News. I don't know whether he wants to say something. Brother Otis Griffin?
No, sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Sister Ayan, are you there, Sister
Ayan?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, Sister Ayan.
Yeah, I'm here. He's back.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Was that Brother Pugh that just spoke?
Yeah, he does. With Brother Pugh.
Yeah. Thank you, Brother Pugh, for breaking everything down so perfectly. He really caught me up in a beautiful way and just said some things that were really powerful.
Yeah, he's good. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just sitting here thinking. I'm more of in a quiet mood tonight, so I don't have a whole lot to say. But I was thinking, in terms of internalized oppression, the objective of oppressing a people psychologically, and having the degree of psychological damage occur that has occurred within us is to disempower the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, as we talk about Du Bois and, you know, Stokely Carmichael and Malcolm and, you know, all the people, all Amos Wilson, all the people, Naeem Akbar, that have taught us, that have led movements and whatnot, we have enough, we have done enough. Even the people during the Jim Crow era that built towns, you know, when white people were, we were being lynched and terrorized and murdered, we still built towns. So we've always been doing and teaching and learning, but we've gotten to the point now, because we haven't healed the self-hatred that we've internalized, where we don't build the way that we used to. And that is a result of internalized internalized oppression, which created learned powerlessness. So we have very wealthy people today. We have so many scholars and so much history, as I talked, as we talked about with the various movements and whatnot. But we're less empowered, and we're going at each other with all these beefs and conflicts in a way that I don't think. And if you could tell me, Doc, has this ever happened on this level where we're going at each other the way that we are and killing each other up and. You know, what's happening on social media with the different various beefs with anybody that, you know, wants to be heard, wants to get attention, they'll start a beef. I mean, we are not building.
Right.
With all that we have. Yeah, am I making sense?
No, you're good. I mean, you're right on point. Right on point.
With all that we have, so we need to ask ourselves, why are we not building the way Garvey said it.
Right.
You know, if you don't do what other people have done, you had better die.
Right. Well, I think that's some of the, that's the problem.
What he's saying, but we need to ask ourselves this question. We're being murdered in the streets. You know, how many brothers were murdered recently that they finally put on social, on national media? You know, these things are still happening. Our black police officers, what are they doing? We got to start to ask ourselves, what are we doing? Or what can we do instead of just talking and analyzing and, you know, what's our next move as a people?
Right.
And why are we not moving?
Right. And that's the purpose for our discussion tonight, to try to begin to hit at some of that and see what it is that we can do, because that is an illness. That is that's a problem. And regardless of what we call it, whether it's menticide, internal oppression, post-traumatic slave syndrome, whatever. You know, the bottom line is that the results is the same. It's the damages from all of this oppression is the same. And that's what we've got to weed through that. We've got to weave through that and begin to look at working some ideas. Education hasn't worked because we don't control the educational system.
Exactly.
So that can't do it. The medical science field hasn't done anything because, you know, that's one of the worst systems. Remember back in slavery, they used to label the Africans who ran away as having dreptomania. They said they had a disease, you know, that made them want to run away, you know, and stuff like that, you know. So that got into the books of psychiatry, and they started treating that. They actually had a treatment for dreptomania. I was just looking at it the other day, and there was a chemical treatment that they were using for slaves that ran away, Africans that ran away. So, yeah, you're right. Now, let me just ask you real quickly, some of the groups that you're working with, I know you're doing a lot of group therapy. What is that like? Is that working? Is that to address some of the things that we are talking about?
I'm sorry, say that again. We have some disturbance.
Some of the things that you are doing there in Greensboro, working with groups, addressing the issues of internalized oppression, mental slavery, and so forth. There were some specific programs that you shared with me some time ago that were being implemented to address those problems. And so I'm saying, is that working? What is it like? Just kind of give our audience a little background to what's being done.
Okay, so there's the Association of Black Psychologists, Dr. Cheryl Griggs, and some others, formulated a process called emotional emancipation circles. And these are circles that are open circles where we come and we talk about are emotional damage that resulted specifically from oppression and white terrorism. I won't call it white supremacy, white terrorism.
Okay.
And so these circles are free, and people can come and start to process the feelings that they're carrying that are self-destructive, mm-hmm. and behaviors that are self-destructive. Mm-hmm. Because once you start to put this stuff out in the open, then you can start a process of healing. But historically, we have not talked about the trauma that we experience, and that's a part of a major problem in terms of why we are not moving the way you would think we would be, mm-hmm. because we have not really been talking about this until the last, I don't know, 20 years to have serious open conversation about this.
Right.
So we have the emotional emancipation circles, and there are, so I've started sister circles, you know, and in the past started a brother circle to give our people a place to come and talk about what I started off saying, what it's like to be a black skin or a very light skinned person in the black community.
Mm-hmm.
Both suffer equally, so much so that we start to hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no way in the world that we'll be able to work together if we're hating each other.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So we've got to putting this stuff out, having a forum, having a safe place where we can talk about how we really feel, what really happened to us, to say things like, no white man ever raped me, a black man raped me.
Mm-hmm.
To have a place to come and say that and then understand why that black man behaved that way. Because, you know, his somebody raped him, and trace it on down to the plantation.
Gotcha.
You know, so, and the other thing is we have to embrace culture. Culture needs to be a part of every conversation, because we are culturally starved and deprived at this point. We don't know who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did come in where you were talking about how we, you know, wait for Jesus to fix it. That's a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
We come from a culture where we could call it magic, but we are spiritually empowered people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things that we can do, but we don't do because we were taught that what we do is wrong and evil. And so we took on this Europeanized Christianity that tells us to wait on Jesus. And so it's had an impact on the masses to where we're robotic.
Mm.
That is very serious.
Right.
That's the power of psychological damage.
Yes, it is.
It can totally disempower a whole group of people. When you think about it, it is just... It's unbelievable.
Right.
So reclaiming our culture, and there's a book. It talks about the dangers of interracial relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But this brother says, or whoever wrote the book, because it's the person's name or the people are called Umoja, so we don't know who Umoja is, and I think that's a very smart move. But they talk about the importance of taking a psychological distancing, detachment from Eurocentric culture. Whatever they say, do, we do the opposite.
Opposite, yes.
Right.
We do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
If they say, you know, hold hands, white people, try to make, we'll love white people to humanity, that may happen, be effective with some, but not with the ones that are killing you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Very good.
So that psychological distancing and detachment from Eurocentric culture is critical. They tell you, when they tell our children that they have a choice with their sexuality, every black person needs to tell our children, no way. I want to say hell no. Hell no. You don't have an option.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if something happens, molestation, you know, whatever, a biological issue, or rather genetic, whatever, then those have to be considered. But other than that, no. Don't let somebody tell your children that they have a choice. That's deliberate.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Well, no, you can't drink coffee now that they found out that it's a carcinogen.
Right.
No. Don't go to Starbucks. There are so many things that we can do, but we have to distance ourselves from this very thick Europeanized culture that's making us sicker.
And I like that. I like that. Well, I got a couple other people I want to get to. As always, I thank you so much for your input. And I'm glad you answered my call. I did call you right before the program. I wanted to get you on to come in and talk about that. But thanks a lot. I really do appreciate that. We'll be talking again toward the middle of the week. I definitely look forward to that conversation and your input on further about this subject. We're going to do this again. I mean, this is obviously something we can't address in 2 hours, but at least I want to start the discussion and start the talking. So thank you so much.
A quick thing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are such a wonderful, wonderful man, and the work you do is powerful. Thank you so much.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay. All right. The next caller is 66602-403. Good afternoon, caller.
Yes, brother, Dr. Rogers.
Oh, hello, my brother. How you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. I'm doing great.
Good.
You know, you are so correct. In fact, we need to do much more because that is the problem. It's
right.
A psychological problem. It's a psychological
yes.
And an economical problem. But it's more a psychological problem because if we can't solve that problem, we can't get our economics together because we can't sit down and trust each other.
That's right.
So I agree with you definitely. What I do, you know, mm-hmm. the information is all over YouTube. You know, that is what's so sad to Dr. Rogers.
Right.
Amos Wilson is on YouTube, Naeem Akbar, all these people is on YouTube. The information is there. You know, we have to solve our problem ourselves. So what I do, I send it to everybody.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. I use this social media and send it to everybody, black person who have an ear I want to hear. And when I'm in the street talking to people, you talk to them because it's by talking you're going to get this, you stimulate action and stimulate thought.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you in your day-to-day conversation with our people, talk to them about these issues.
You have to.
See, because, yes, those are things we can do to solve this problem. And, you know, I heard a sister talking earlier and she was saying, you know, building. But we have to remember, you know, we have built in this country. It's
mm-hmm.
not say we haven't built, but it has been destroyed. See, there is a effort to make sure that we don't, you know. Once had a friend used to be in the movement, passed away years ago.
Right.
And
agree.
Said the FBI came to him. FBI came to him with a French FBI officer, and his French officer told him, he said, "Look, you're not going to build no black empire in America." That's what the FBI agent told him, said, "You ain't gonna build no black empire." So these people have no intention of us building. You know, we're not gonna solve the problem here, because this is a nut house.
Yes, it is.
So he got too many things going, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So those of us who have our minds together, we got to go prepare a place, because it's gonna come down, you know, to a point where they might start turning black people up in here.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay, and so we gonna have to make a shift pretty soon.
Really soon. You're right. That's so true.
Anyway, I continue listening, good brother. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate that. I look forward to your continued support of the program.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yes
indeed,
brother. We'll do.
Okay, my good brother from 324. He is hosting his own program. Here on the Black Reality, not Black Reality Think Tank, but Time for Awakening. Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, good afternoon, my brother.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. How are you this evening?
I'm wonderful, sir. I'm wonderful, wonderful.
I've enjoyed, I've listened from the beginning, outstanding program.
Great.
As always, appreciate what you do and
how you
present it in the educational, you know, seems like you're at. You're teaching at UWM, man.
I do. And the same work you do, my brother. Same thing, man. You know, you do some mighty stuff, mighty hand. I appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole thing is what we're trying to do on Time for an Awakening, on the Motherland Media, your program, my program, is help to, as Stephen Biko said, the most potent weapon in the hands of these folks, the oppressor, the European, the Caucasian, whatever you want to call it, is the mind of the oppressed.
That's right.
And your program, my program, and this station is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind.
That's right.
It is the mind.
That's
You know, when you talk about internalized racism, of post-traumatic syndrome, all of these concepts, all these words, the bottom line is that our minds are messed up.
Right.
We cannot think clear. We cannot think outside of the imposed boundaries that Europeans have placed upon us. We can't release the vice grip that the Caucasian has on our mind. And if you understand that tool, once the vice grip is set, you just can't pull it apart.
Right.
But there's a knob at the end of the handle.
Mm-hmm.
And the turning that knob is symbolic of acquiring knowledge of self, information, and love who you are. And the more you acquire, the better you're able to turn that knob until you finally release that vice grip. And you see the Caucasian for who and what they are, but you understand that they suffer from cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing we can do or say that will change their mind and their attitude about who and what they are. They believe they're superior, even though there's a plethora of information and proving otherwise.
That's right.
But they dismiss it, they ignore it, because, you know, it doesn't fit what they're trying to present and what they're trying to impose on the world.
That's right.
So it is a constant battle to fight. And I call it, this is what I call it, Doc, European Caucasian extremism, racism, and privilege.
That's true.
Because that's it right there. That is what is happening around the world as far as Caucasians are concerned. Because everywhere they go, that's the mentality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see just recently the Australians offered the Caucasians who were going to get their land taken from them without being compensated. They're offering a special immigration program for them in Australia. But even at that, the United States, the European Union, and Australia are saying, if you do this to them, we're going to boycott you. We're going to put an economic strangle on South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just like what the brother asked, but the brother in Ghana told the French. We don't need it.
Right.
Go ahead and do it. Because really, Doc, you know, I think,
that's right.
You know, when we talk about solutions to this problem,
right,
the only solution to this problem is an embracing a dynamic program of Pan-Africanism.
Yep.
One that is technical, cultural, and spiritual.
I agree.
That's
yes,
the only
indeed.
Solution for us.
That is exactly right.
It is. I mean, Dr. Clark said it. All of them have said it. All of the African Center scholars who studied this issue, who studied the history, realized that's it. There is, because the bottom line is, there is nothing we can do to make Caucasians change how they feel about us. There's nothing we can do.
Nothing.
And there's nothing that we can do that we can make them respect our humanity and respect and our dignity. There's nothing we can do.
Right.
And we should stop trying it, because it's fruitless for us to continue to try to do this. It's a serious waste of time.
Right.
And you can see the impact on us globally. You
right.
can see the impact where, you know, we hate ourselves.
Yes,
we hate
we
our
do.
Hair.
Yep,
we hate
sure
our skin
do.
Color. We hate ourselves. And because we hate ourselves, we hate each other. And we blame each other. We say crazy, stupid stuff like we are our own worst enemy. You know.
That's exactly right.
And then of course and then to say that, you know, is not to understand what put us in this position to begin with.
Right.
We blame each other.
Exactly. Can you what would you think a Pan-African program would look like in 2018? How do you see that being formulated? Because I agree with you. I totally agree that would be the agenda. And I think about it, though, from an older model, obviously. I think about it from the Nkrumah and Du Bois model of doing it. How do you think a modern version of that might look?
I think that here's how I envision it, Doc. You know, there's a serious awakening in the African family.
Okay.
On the continent and throughout the diaspora. This serious awakening is causing Africans to begin to support, love, and respect one another.
That
and
is
to
true.
Share with one another.
I think there is a change.
The education is just like what European Jews told the school systems, that you can teach my children English and science and math, but it is my responsibility to teach these children what it means to be a European Jew.
Right.
So we have education whatever day of the week or on Saturday, whatever. It is our responsibility.
That's
I liken that to us.
Mm-hmm.
We go to these schools here, even on the continent, but the whole process is the education for the liberation of African people
right.
and the African mind. You instill the culture, you instill the history, you make the people understand who they are, what they have done, making them once again believe in themselves,
mm-hmm.
and then once again to make them understand the importance of trust and respect for one another, you see. So, and then once that's done, those with skills,
right.
and the brothers and sisters on the continent with skills, come together to rebuild Africa.
I agree.
Railroad,
I agree.
Highway, port, school, hospitals, all the things that we as African people need, and but more importantly, control the land.
Okay. Well, that's
control
something
the
that,
land
that's
and
a
control
subject.
Control the resources in the land.
That's a subject
see,
that I want to definitely revisit.
We are not a poor people.
Right.
We are, in fact, probably the richest people on the planet if we control the resources that we have.
Right. Right. And that's
you
true.
Know,
I want to revisit that. I want to have a discussion, a future discussion, because we got about 8 minutes left, and I do want you to talk. I want you to talk about the other programs that are on the air, because I want to get a. I don't have that copy yet to be
okay,
with.
Okay, I'll make sure you get that.
Okay.
So
would you just kind of tell us about some of the upcoming programs?
I'll give you the rundown. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, it's my program. African Perspectives, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. The times I'm going to give are Eastern time. My program is 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. On Monday evening, it's Acres of Diamonds, public affairs program right out of Philadelphia, from 6 to 8. From 8 to 9 is Let's Buy Black 365, which also is simulcast on Facebook. Let's Buy Black 365. On Tuesday, it's Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. On Wednesday, it's Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10. Sister Revive. Thursday, Uplifting Us, Food, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People in the Spirit of Ujamaa, Cooperative Economics, or as we like to say, Family-Centered Economics. And that is 9 p.m. to 10, Fulu, Uplifting Us. Friday. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern time, it's time for an awakening
mm-hmm.
with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Time for an awakening. Saturday, Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore from 10 to 12 noon. Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. And then Sunday, Revive from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. No, it's not me. It's just the POC with Revive again. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sunday. And then Sunday evening from 7 p.m., once again, it's time for an awakening.
Beautiful.
So that's the rundown right now.
Beautiful.
There are some other programs that are being scheduled to come on and join us in the broadcast. So
fantastic. Well, Brother Oshie, I appreciate you for doing that. I appreciate your sponsorship for the Black Reality Think Tank. And I look forward to some upcoming great events with Motherland Media, as well as Time for Awakening. I'm really excited about it. Yes, I'm really excited.
Yeah, because I look at what we can do in terms of bringing in people and so forth, something public where we can announce those things,
right.
Not just here in Atlanta, but elsewhere as well.
Okay.
You know, because it reaches broad.
Okay.
And we're doing the best that we can to help free the African mind.
Amen. Amen.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We have reached the time at the end of our program. I look forward to you all joining us next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Here on the Black Reality Think Tank. Have a wonderful and very productive week.
You know, sometimes we're not prepared for adversity. When it happens, sometimes we're caught short. Thank you.
we don't know exactly how to handle it when it comes up. Sometimes we don't know just what to do when adversity takes over. And I have advice for all of us. I got it from our pianist, Joe Zavidu, who wrote this tune. And it sounds like what you're supposed to say when you have that kind of problem. It's called Mercy. Mercy. Mercy.